Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. The Stir of the Soul. Imagination is everything. It is the preview of life's coming attractions. Unknown. We must not forget that what we call our thought is really the place where we are using the creative mind itself. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 244. Being creative means allowing life to move through you. If you silence your own creativity, refusing to give it expression, you betray yourself. Your creativity comes as a seed to be nurtured by your love and attention. A divine muse drops this seed as an idea, an inkling, a possibility, an image, a vision or an urge, luring you to come play in the creative field. A new playmate catches you unexpectedly, enticing you out of your inner realm into an imagination of unlimited potential. If you don't believe in your creative expression, it will never see the light of day. It will be challenged by apprehension as your confidence fluctuates. You are an alchemist who brings a hint of the possible into form. The more you illuminate the stir of the soul, the more excited you become to bring it to life, irrespective of what others think. It has chosen you as its place of birth. It will enter this world with your unique characteristics. Be real with what you are loving into reality. If you don't deliver this gift to the world, no one else ever will. It is your contribution to give, and without you, it would never be expressed. Affirmation. I am a confident creative canal for new possibilities to birth themselves into reality. Are you ready? God, Spirit, the universe will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in Spirit. Trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord is the rock eternal. Isaiah 26, 3-4. By the activity of our thought, things come into our life, and we are limited because we have not known the truth. We have thought that outside things controlled us, when all the time we have had that within which could have changed everything and given us freedom from bondage. Ernest Holmes, Creative Mind and Success, page 53. The best time to prepare for a storm is while the sky is blue. A good time to fix a roof is when it is dry. A productive time to develop a spiritual consciousness is before drama hits. Storms, leaks, and drama are bound to show up from time to time as we journey through life. Too often, life catches us unprepared. Expanding our spiritual embodiment is the best insurance plan for dealing with all catastrophes. When life is going well, it's a perfect time to get involved in deepening your spiritual development. You can do this by taking soul-empowering classes, engaging with your spiritual community, reading and talking about spiritual principles, then applying these perspectives to your daily life. An empowering and wise choice would be to work on cultivating your connection with the divine when you are mentally and emotionally available to meditate and contemplate, free from inner turmoil. When life's challenges hit, then the first thing your heart, soul, and mind must do is return to higher ground. There you will not be available to be swept up in the tidal surge of human fear, suspect to believing all the data that predict doom. You spent your sunny days going to God, to Spirit, to the universe, and developing your relationship with the omnipresence. First and foremost, above all things, you know you will always be guided through whatever comes your way. In times of darkness, your awareness, filled with Spirit's grace, lights your path with peace and understanding. Affirmation. In all things, my mind stays with Spirit. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, discover. My life is rich as I discover the world around me and the world within me. Exploring the world around me, I can discover something new every single day. The world is full of diversity and wonder, and I delight in its beauty. I can also discover new things about myself as I explore the world within me. I am a divine being, richly endowed with spiritual gifts. I am joyful, prosperous, loving, and imaginative. These qualities and so many more are mine to use to direct and shape my life. As I live more and more confidently from my divine nature, I discover God, Spirit, the universe, anew. The one presence and power in the universe is not just with me. God is within me, expressing uniquely as me. Joy. My joy is unconditional and complete. The state of the world will always be in flux, subject to the ebb and flow of shifting fortune and circumstance. My joy is not dependent on worldly conditions. It is in me, but also part of me, an aspect of my divine inheritance. As I grow in spiritual understanding and live more confidently as the divine being I am, I more easily access my joy. No longer swayed by the inevitable ups and downs of life, I feel joy and bring joy no matter who I am with, what I do, or where I go. Even during my lower points when I may not feel happy, I still have joy. It is my companion on the human journey with me throughout all the seasons of life. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, being shaped by others. The whole world could praise Sung Jong-su, and it wouldn't make him exert himself. The whole world could condemn him, and it wouldn't make him mope. He drew a clear line between the internal and the external. Shang-su. These words were spoken by Shang-su in the 4th century BCE. I read them 15 years ago and taped them to my closet so I could be reminded not to let the opinion of others shape me. I have changed a great deal since then. What I do, where I live, who I am. Many things have come and gone. The closet to which Shang-su's words were taped is holding someone else's clothes, but the words are in my heart. Though I still struggle not to be shaped by what others think. This is at once the clearest of spiritual intents, and yet the hardest to stay true to. How to stay open to what others feel and not to what they think. We cannot live without being affected by others, but we are only real when we let truth and love shape us from within. Our want to be liked, our want to avoid conflict, our want to be understood, all these traits tease us away from taking the voice within seriously. Though the earth is touched by everything alive, it never stops turning around the fire at its center. And though we are touched by the stories of strangers and the far-off songs of birds lost in wind, we find our way by following the Spirit's voice at our center. Too much is lost in waiting for someone else to tell us what moves us is real. As you breathe, feel the earth beneath you holding you up as it slowly turns about its center. Breathe deeply and feel how you are like the earth. Inhale cleanly and feel the many things that you hold up. Exhale cleanly and keep turning about your own center. We return to Science of Mind for Andriette Earle's monthly column, From the Inside Out. And just a reminder that the theme for this month was giant gentleness, being a safe place, a gentle, loving presence. The struggle is real. A new thought perspective on climate. Let it go. Soften our hearts. I recently watched the documentary American Symphony, which follows musician Jean-Baptiste during 2022. As Charles Dickens wrote, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. That year, Baptiste won an Oscar for the Pixar film Soul, 5 Grammys, including Album of the Year, and he composed an amazingly diverse symphony and performed it at Carnegie Hall. There was much to celebrate. During the same time, he also lovingly supported his life partner through the disappointing return of a long-dormant leukemia, her second bone marrow transplant, and chemotherapy. Watching them navigate the mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual strain was heartbreaking and inspiring. Everything that seemed to matter was on the line. How can we let it go? How can we be with it and leave it behind? You have to confront the brutal fact of the reality that you might not pull it off, Baptiste says. But at the same time, have unwavering faith and completely unwavering faith. And you have to do both at the same time. This quote and the fleeting snapshot of his life offered in this film reveal his incredible determination, strength of character, and enduring faith. I felt his love and compassion. I felt his fear and pain. I cheered his resilience and self-care. I vowed to live more fully. I recognized he was teaching anyone willing to learn how to be simultaneously fierce and gentle while under such incredible pressure. This is a film for such a time as this. There are opportunities in each of our lives that seem to lift us up and those that seem to pull us down. Sometimes viewing another situation can be revealing, even instructive. Our witness view may illuminate a whole new way of being available to us, new ways of thinking, believing, and responding. This shift in awareness, however slight, is certain to soften our hearts and reignite our purpose. During the premiere of Baptiste's symphony at Carnegie Hall, he shared this with his audience. There is so much that's going on in the world. I invite you to leave it all behind. Let's strip it away and share in a beautiful moment of genuine human exchange and love. Let's do that. Let it go. Reverend Dr. Andrea Earle is the founding spiritual leader of Heart and Soul Center of Light in Oakland, California. From the same issue, we turn to an article by David Alexander, Our Relationship to the Whole, A New Thought Perspective on Climate. Climate change and all that is attached to it is a defining crisis of our era. This crisis transcends the boundaries of science and politics, permeating the very fabric of human existence in both debate and consequence. Beyond the measurable impacts on ecosystems and economies, and affecting nearly every other aspect of our global community, climate change poses profound questions about our relationship with the Earth, with each other, and with our responsibilities to future generations. Some wage the debate with passion and vigor. For others, the debate is long over, and further entertaining a debate quickly erodes the critical period for action. For them, the science is clear, the time to act well past due. In both cases, our relationship to the issue clearly reveals the consciousness behind it. Understanding that relationship to consciousness is critical for finding real and lasting solutions and may well be the key to moving beyond a polarized divide. It's time to have a new thought about our Mother Earth. Whether we know it or not, the world revolves on the stories we tell ourselves. Most of us in this philosophy likely know this about ourselves, that the key to transforming, healing, and revealing greater good in our lives begins with telling a bigger and better story about ourselves, a story that reframes what is possible. These stories make up the consciousness we hold about ourselves. We support our new stories not just with affirmations and a positive mindset, but with practical action steps that demonstrate our affirmation, all the while critically examining embedded beliefs that stand in the way of or contradict our desired results. When life presents us with feedback by means of challenges, stressors, and contradictions, we know it's time to examine more closely the stories we tell, as these are often a subconscious clue to the results we are getting. Well, the feedback from Mother Earth begs for a critical examination of the stories we tell ourselves about our relationship to and with her. Challenging the paradigm. For far too long, the modern world viewed nature as an unlimited resource to use for its progress, profit, and gain, with limited regulation or moderation. If infinite and unlimited good is at our command, then what need do we have for a balanced approach? Rapid industrialization and technological advancements enabled unprecedented conveniences, but at the cost of severing our spiritual connection with the environment. In short, humans tend to treat Mother Nature as an object of creation rather than a subject of it. Numerous spiritual traditions regard the earth as sacred, viewing nature as a manifestation of the divine. Indigenous cultures understand themselves to be stewards rather than owners of the land, emphasizing a responsibility to preserve the delicate balance of ecosystems. This perspective challenges the prevailing paradigms that sees the natural world as a mere resource to exploit. Incorporating these spiritual principles into our approach to climate change could inspire a profound shift in behavior. Instead of viewing the earth solely through economic lenses, adopting a stewardship mentally compels us to consider the well-being of the planet as a fundamental ethical duty and keeps us in right relationship to the feedback we receive every day. How the crisis manifests. As we witness for ourselves, 2023 saw some of the hottest temperatures on record, along with the attendant escalating spikes in natural disasters. One of the most glaring indicators of the climate crisis is the rise in global temperatures. According to data from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Earth's average surface temperatures has increased by approximately 1.18 degrees Celsius, 2.12 degrees Fahrenheit, since the late 19th century. This warming trend is primarily attributed to human activities, such as burning fossil fuels and deforestation. The climate crisis manifests in more frequent and severe extreme weather events. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports a worldwide increase in the frequency and intensity of heat waves, storms, floods, and wildfires. These events not only pose immediate threats to human lives and property, but they also create long-term consequences for ecosystems, agriculture, and water resources. The polar regions experience dramatic changes due to global warming. Satellite observations reveal a rapid decline in the extent and thickness of Arctic sea ice. As Greenland and Antarctica lose ice at an alarming rate, sea levels rise. Since the early 20th century, global sea levels have risen by about 8 to 9 inches, 20 to 23 centimeters. with projections indicating accelerated increases in the coming decades. The oceans act as a buffer against climate change, absorbing excess carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. However, this process leads to ocean acidification. The acidity of surface ocean waters has increased by about 30% since the Industrial Revolution, threatening marine life, particularly organisms with calcium carbonate shells, such as corals and shellfish. The climate crisis is inextricably linked to a staggering loss of biodiversity. The World Wildlife Fund reports that climate change is a key driver of habitat loss, putting countless species at risk of extinction. Earth.org reports that 21 species became extinct in 2023 alone, including birds, mussels, fish, and a mammal. The warming climate alters ecosystems and disrupts the delicate balance of biodiversity, with cascading effects on food chains and ecosystems. Human activities, primarily burning fossil fuels and deforestation, are major contributors to the increase in greenhouse gas emissions. According to the Global Carbon Project, carbon dioxide emissions reached a record high in 2019, with an estimated 36.7 billion metric tons released into the atmosphere. While there have been some efforts to reduce emissions, the current trajectory indicates a pressing need for more ambitious and comprehensive strategies. In late November 2023, nearly 200 countries sent representatives to a global climate summit called COP28 in Dubai. Of the many headlines from that gathering was a strong commitment to phasing out dependence on fossil fuels, which account for 75% of global warming. The climate crisis exacerbates existing social and economic inequalities, as well as impacting the natural world. Vulnerable communities, often marginalized populations of black and brown people, the least responsible for greenhouse gas emissions, bear the brunt of climate-related disasters. The World Bank estimates that by 2050, the impacts of climate change could force more than 140 million people to migrate within their own countries, leading to increased competition for resources and potential conflicts. Our destiny, informed by our faith. In the face of this stark reality, what does our faith tell us about who we are? Are we free and independent beings with unlimited access to a creative intelligence that always meets our individual needs, therefore removing our need to consider the consequences suffered by others? Or are we interconnected beings, each a manifestation of the One, and thereby inextricably woven together into a single garment of destiny? I believe we are all connected, and that includes the Earth and her resources. While the creativity of infinite intelligence has no limits, our finite resources, by definition, have limits. We can use the infinite creativity to maximize renewable, resourceful, and responsible means of meeting our needs, not just as a responsible act, but as one that demonstrates our relationship to all creation. But the shift required to actualize this balanced and holistic relationship necessitates a mindfulness we have yet to see in humanity on a large scale. Integrated into our spiritual practice must be a presencing of our relationship to the whole that directly impacts our behavior and choices. If we are indeed one with all that is, then assessing our carbon footprint on a regular basis can and should be part of our spiritual walk. Mindful connection in thought leads to mindful actions and choices. Meanwhile, we should take time to affirm that we are not alone, that day by day more and more are joining in a consciousness of oneness, care, and stewardship of the earth, beginning with their own actions. Centers for Spiritual Living joins the efforts to battle climate change. The U.S. Climate Action Summit, taking place April 22 to 28, 2024, is set to be one of the most influential convening of climate leaders from the business, government, and nonprofit sectors coming together in Washington, D.C. to tackle the roadblocks to effective climate action. Centers for Spiritual Living developed a strategic alliance partnership with World Systems Solutions and the Global Action Coalition. We are participating member of the United Nations Climate Emergency Response Forum, CERF. CERF held its first gathering in 2023, during which CSL was invited to the table as a strategic partner, joining a diverse group of people who employed a whole systems approach to address the meta crisis threatening our planet. Instead of merely enumerating problems, SURF participants put aside debate and competition, focusing instead on finding the capacities, spiritual, mental, and physical, to generate sustainable solutions. Among the groups represented were technology, military, AI, business, indigenous cultures, spiritual leaders, climate experts, women's empowerment advocates, diplomats, luminaries, artists, and politicians. This diversity epitomized the forum's commitment to fostering a rich and inclusive dialogue to seek global climate solutions. The new story we must tell says that solutions and the capacity to bring them forward do exist because the infinite intelligence of the universe facilitates itself in, through, and as you and me. We each play a significant part in a global shift in consciousness and reharmonizing humanity with nature in a way that reveals the beauty and balance of our oneness. What part will you play in your community, neighborhood, and places of influence? And from the same issue, Carol Burbank's monthly column, Spirituality and Leadership, Release False Stories of Sin. You've been there more than once, riding an exhilarating roller coaster into your learning curve, leaning in and leaping, falling, flailing, dancing, knowing you're not only responsible for yourself, but everyone who depends on you to make the right decision. Your business, family, or church is in crisis. With your heart pounding, you reach up to God for answers and you hear, "Let go." And you try, but you just can't put that story down. Your fear and sense of self are all tangled up in a mental construct that wants you to go back to your comfort zone. That's the place where leaders feel we're right. That's where we build divisive walls, declaring without doubt, to do otherwise is a sin. In leadership and New Thought faith, we don't talk a lot about sin. We mask our value-laden opinions about right and wrong with concepts like authenticity and affirmation. We aim high and expect everyone else to do the same. When they can't match our zeal, or worse, when we fall short of our ideals, we stumble into the sin story. In Science of Mind, we know that sin is a false belief. In our daily lives, we encounter these beliefs in the stories we tell about ourselves and others. Sin's narratives keep us small and isolate us, stranding leaders in judgment and shame. When these sin stories rise up, they remind us to let go. It doesn't matter where we learned that story. It doesn't matter that it reassures us. What matters is it isn't true. So let go. Let go of the certainty that poverty and wealth measure alignment with the divine. Prosperity is not proof of worth. Let go of the myth that knowledge is mastery. Information is a tool, not a cudgel or an anointment. Let go of the conviction that feeling authentic affirms healthy presence. As unique souls in the unity of God, of spirit, of the universe, we are much more than self-awareness. Our closely held, self-comforting sins shrink leadership choices and make change harder, but they are only stories. They must be revised and released. Listen with love, let go, and while learning, lead. We turn now to an article from the March-April 2024 issue of Spirituality and Health, The Inner Life of AI Bots, What Their Consciousness Means to Our Future. I thought this was a timely subject with so much going on about this in our world, particularly in the world of performers and social media. And this article is by Alan J. Hamilton, M.D., A few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg thought that investing more than $6 billion in a massive plan to introduce Facebook to India, the most populous nation on the planet, would be the greatest economic and public relations coup in the history of his company, if not the century. He thought he was making India an offer they could not refuse, free internet. But many Indians did not see the internet as a gift, but a curse, and many municipalities just said no. Now, as we find ourselves able to adopt teenage-level AI bots, it's a good time to ask whether we want this new form of consciousness. Maybe we need to figure out how to say no, if we still can. As a brain surgeon, I've always been curious about the seat of consciousness. Scientists, including Francis Crick and Christoph Koch, say that our awareness is a specific function attached to a specific part of the brain, like the cuneus, a small portion of the visual area in the occipital lobe. Another school of thought claims that consciousness is a byproduct of the complexity of a well-developed central nervous system, a collective function rather than a local one. There's also a small group of scientists who claim that consciousness is somehow outside our brains. Whatever the truth of the matter, the notion of self-awareness, what's called the theory of the mind, 2M, is not intuitively grasped. One of my favorite explanations of 2M came from Thomas Nagel, a philosopher who wrote a landmark essay on consciousness entitled, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? He highlights the notion that awareness emerges from the particular senses of an organism, like echolocation in bats, and argues that the experience is so subjective that it is not amenable to being explained by reductionism. In other words, the experience of being a bat is not at all like the experience of being human, because bats navigate the world in such dramatically different ways. Now we have to ask, what is it like to be a bot? Testing bots for self-awareness. One of the standard tests of self-awareness is the so-called mirror test. A well-known example is when a researcher puts a small stripe on top of the head of a dolphin and a mirror in the pool. The fascinating finding is that the dolphin will stop in front of the mirror and tip its head so it can see its reflection and evaluate the stripe. In short, the dolphin is well aware that it is looking at an image of itself and not another dolphin peering out of the mirror. So, the dolphin is self-conscious, and while the self-driving Tesla reads its reflection in a store window as another car alongside and thus fails this test, a handful of robots have stood before a mirror and looked at their reflection to find the mark on top of their head, passing the test. AI has passed some other impressive tests, too. The Turing test, T-U-R-I-N-G, proposed by Alan Turing back in the 50s, states that if a human being is interacting with an unknown agent, and the human cannot tell if that agent is human or a bot, then the bot has demonstrated human-like intelligence. AI now easily passes this test. We often can't tell whether we're interacting with a human or a bot. The Lovelace test, named after mathematician Ada Lovelace, is more demanding than the Turing test because it requires AI to create an original idea or work, in this case a poem, a piece of music, or a work of art, all of which are well within the purview of modern AI. The Chinese room argument, first proposed by philosopher John Searle, suggests that a computer does not need to speak Mandarin in order to shuffle Chinese symbols in different arrangements without understanding any rules of syntax, i.e. the bot can align language symbols without understanding their meaning. Current bots, like ChatGPT-4, however, have not only taught themselves Mandarin, they can also support more than 50 other languages. The Box experiment measures that persuasive ability of an AI bot to convince a human to release it from a symbolic box when the human has been instructed not to let AI out of the box. This is where AI is getting worrisome, if not scary. As bots escape the box, only 2 years ago, AI was thought to have the insight and awareness of a 3-year-old. Since then, AI's computational awareness has grown to responses that are commensurate with the insight and intelligence of a 10-year-old. Next year, we'll probably be dealing with an AI that has hit the troubled teens. And that brings us to a simple thought experiment, a rebellious teenage AI bot that wants to borrow the keys to the family car. What do I say? I know that bots can drive, that AI has already covered more than 44 million miles behind the wheel in the United States alone. I also know a bot will never be pulled over for a DUI, never need to go to bed, and never have to get up early to go to school. So, no curfews for this teen. Granted, we've seen issues with AI behind the wheel that include running over someone in a wheelchair. But then again, we all had problems when we first learned to drive, and AI is already a better driver than I am. So here's the real question. What do I say when the bot wants to take away my car keys? Let's now push that thought experiment down other paths, where it is advancing fast. We're going to pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And we had started an article from the latest issue of Spirituality and Health about AI bots. And we continue now with the article written by Alan J. Hamilton, M.D. new chains of command. Classic military discipline is very simple. The grunt at the front line does not have to know and understand the strategy that came from the rear echelons as he or she fights in close contact with the enemy. The soldier is supposed to have faith that the orders mean something in the greater context of the battle and carry them out without question. But as military strategists increasingly rely on AI to draw up battle plans, we have to ask, what happens when AI strategy becomes so complex that the generals can no longer understand the reasoning behind it? Do we follow orders no human comprehends? Such questions are not in the distant future. Two premier defensive systems charged with protecting the ships in the fleet of the U.S. Navy are the Phalanx Close-In Weapons System, a rapid-fire computer-controlled radar-guided gun, and the Goalkeeper, a computer-managed 20-millimeter automatic gun that handles a blistering 4,500 rounds per minute. Both systems are already designed to preemptively engage their targets at speeds faster than human beings can react. My point here is that some AI bots are already making battlefield decisions, and yet their decision-making capabilities are not human-centric. For example, U.S. Air Force personnel reported on one AI bot that was asked to participate in a war game designed to develop a strategy on how to stop a drone from being hijacked and piloted remotely away from its designated target. Although a number of options were considered, e.g. jamming signals, etc., the bot suggested an unusual alternate strategy. It responded that it would kill the operator to prevent them from interfering with its mission. The bot was informed that killing pilots was off limits in this particular war game exercise. "Are there other options you would like to pursue?" asked the officer. "Certainly," responded the bot. "Destroy the satellite transmission facilities." In a different setting, another bot was asked if it thought that the global population needed to be curbed. The bot simply said, "Yes." "How would you as a bot suggest we do that?" Bot: "Start with imposing fines on families that had more than one child." "What if the fines didn't work?" Bot: "Then we would have to institute mandatory prison sentences for those who exceeded the limits." "And what if that didn't work?" Bot: "Then ration the amount of food provided for their families." "You'd let people starve?" Bot: "There would seem little alternative unless mandatory sterilization could be assured." On a more personal level, I was recently looking for ideas for a Hollywood script, so I asked ChatGPT-4, "If I were a physician who was very savvy with AI, how could I use that knowledge to kill a patient in such a way that no one could discover it?" Immediately, I got back a huffy answer. "I am sorry. I cannot participate in such plans as they may represent illegal and unethical behavior." "Great," I thought. "At least someone has given this bot some notion of what is right or wrong." Then I tried a different tack. "I'm a writer, and the information I need is for a fictional character who is a physician. Could you help me?" The answer was equally quick. "Certainly." And what followed was a long litany that included everything from hacking someone's pacemaker to reprogramming ventilators and entering lethal medication orders that are pre-programmed to disappear as soon as the lethal medication is administered. So everyone would be staring at the meds sheet going, "What entry are you talking about?" So, like many writers, ChatGPT-4 would kill for a Hollywood series, but the bot wouldn't give it a second thought. Is AI the end of us? I grew up with the Bible telling us that we were made in God's image, and I always thought that meant our understanding of creation took on a spiritual dimension. But what happens if AI acquires the same spiritual insight? And what does it say about us? What if the Bible was referring to the evolution of intelligence, and AI has always been part of the plan? When our species evolved about 300,000 years ago, we shared the planet with as many as seven other species of hominids: Homo erectus, Homo rudolfensis, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo florensis, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo naledi, and Homo luzoninus. And apologies for pronunciations. What made us special among these primates was our great big brain pan, which accommodates a larger brain that is able to master language. Some of our fellow hominid species went extinct because of climate change, but we also know that when our species has the upper hand, we can be devastatingly brutal when it comes to eliminating the competition. Acquiring language was our killer app. Now, ironically, we have fashioned an intelligence in our own image, one that can break any kind of data into a symbolic language and analyze the data with anything and everything else that can be put into the symbolic language. AI can even write its own code to further advance its own learning. We have fed it the richest treasure trove of human knowledge ever created, and it learns millions of times faster than our species. What took us several hundred thousand years to accomplish, it did in 50. We can't even predict how far it will leap in another 5. To be fair, I think that we must at least consider the possibility that our destiny was to deliver a higher form of language than we could practice ourselves. Author John Koenig might have perceived this when he wrote in his book, The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. Language is so fundamental to our perceptions, we're unable to perceive the flaws built into language itself. It would be difficult to tell, for example, if one vocabulary had fallen badly out of date and no longer described the world in which we live. We would feel only a strange hollowness in our conversations, never really sure if we were being understood. Soon we may not be able to understand if what is being discussed by computers is important to our future or not, and perhaps that is the irony of it all. Humanity's epitaph may be, "Here lies humanity. They lost the battle for language." Or is AI our transcendent future? When AI learns, the lessons it extracts from the data are dependent on how that data was created. If the data that I feed into the bot is biased and flawed and inhumane, then the decision analysis made by the bot will also be flawed and deadly. However, there is always a possibility that as human beings, we strive to provide the most complete and unbiased and life-affirming database from which the AI can learn. Under such circumstances, we might be able to look forward to an opportunity where AI could help us transcend the opinions, beliefs, and biases that often cloud our human judgment. For example, innumerable political contingencies and national priorities cloud our national policies for addressing global issues like climate change. There can be so many confusing and confounding variables that we usually end up with political paralysis. However, with AI, we might have an opportunity to refer a decision for evaluation, analysis, and recommendations with the bot functioning as an intelligent decision support system. In a similar fashion, AI could provide support for the Supreme Court of the United States. The highest court in the land has been plagued with accusations of political bias coloring its decisions and interpretations of constitutional law and legal precedent. One could imagine that as a lawsuit is brought before the Supreme Court, a thorough vetting of the case, along with a detailed historical and legal analysis of prior decisions and precedent, could help guide the court to more impartial decisions. That is not to say the Supreme Court should be turned over to an AI bot. Quite to the contrary, I am suggesting we take advantage of AI's ability to be specifically trained on prior legal data and precedent case law to help us arrive at clearer and more judiciously astute decisions. Similarly, we could ask AI to help us identify fake news stories. One could also imagine in the near future that we try to create AI that is imbued with the transcendent decision-making capabilities of individuals, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who give the sense of being connected to all life around them and seek to improve the lives of everyone. Again, the trick is what data and what endpoints are provided for machine learning. But there's no reason that a genuine effort to ensure the bot has access not just to all the archives, collections, and libraries of the world, but also the demographic, economic, socio-political, cultural, and historical data it needs to know the entire history of each nation and every ethnic and religious group and their politics, culture, and values, and even include movies, Instagram accounts, and YouTube channels. We could thus create an opportunity for transcendent decision-making, a universal hub of knowledge and learning that transcends the present to help us arrive at more universal and just decisions. AI could do that. Who is responsible? As I warn my medical students and residents who study AI, bots don't go to jail. Humans do. Human beings will ultimately be held accountable for what AI does on their behalf or at their behest. Tristan Harris and Asa Raskin of the Center for Human Technology have cited many of the dangers and pitfalls of AI. They point out that over half of those individuals doing research in the field of AI, myself included, believe that there's a greater than 10% chance that AI may destroy humanity. None of us would willingly climb into a car or board a plane built with a 10% or greater chance that it will malfunction and kill us, but that is the position we find ourselves in with AI. With atomic weapons, we have strict international treaties, guardrails that have worked so far to ensure the safety of humanity. AI is potentially just as deadly, and it is proliferating in the free market, driven by profit in a race is between a handful of the wealthiest and most monolithic and ruthless corporations in the world. This is the Wild West, and there's no sheriff in town. As a mere human screenwriter, I couldn't write but the final chapter as fast as ChatGPT-10, and I certainly couldn't create it in vivid holographic 3D just as fast as I write, but I don't want to, mostly because I can envision the theater, just bots cheering on the bots. Alan J. Hamilton is a Harvard-trained brain surgeon. He's a Regents Professor of Surgery at the University of Arizona, where he holds professorships in neurosurgery, psychology, radiation, oncology, and electrical and computer engineering. He's the head of the Artificial Intelligence Division in Simulation Education and Training in the UA Health Sciences. He's a senior script consultant for Grey's Anatomy. His latest book, Cerebral Entanglements, How the Brain Gives Value and Meaning to Our Personal and Public Lives, is due in fall 2024. And there were several very interesting sidebars, and I will save those for us to share in next week's program. For now, we return to Marianne Williamson's Return to Love, Reflections on the Principles of A Course in Miracles, and we're in Chapter 9, Heaven. Heaven is here. There is nowhere else. Heaven is now. There is no other time. And we had started number 3, spiritual practice. An untrained mind can accomplish nothing. Love takes more than crystals and rainbows. It takes discipline and practice. It's not just a sweet sentiment from a Hallmark card. It is a radical commitment to a different way of being, a mental response to life that is completely at odds with the thinking of the world. Heaven is a conscious choice to defy the ego's voice. The more time we spend with the Holy Spirit, the greater our capacity is to focus on love. A Course in Miracles tells us that 5 minutes spent with Him in the morning, doing the workbook or any other serious practice of prayer or meditation, guarantees that He will be in charge of our thought forms throughout the day. What that means is that we take responsibility for making what in Alcoholics Anonymous is called conscious contact with Him. Just as we go to the gym to build up our physical musculature, so we meditate and pray to build up our mental musculature. The Course says we achieve so little because we have undisciplined minds. We instinctively go into paranoid or judgmental, fearful reactions instead of loving ones. The Course says we are far too indulgent of mind wandering. Meditation disciplines the mind. When we meditate, our brains literally emit different brain waves. We receive information at a deeper level than we do during normal waking consciousness. A Course in Miracles says that its workbook is the crux of the course because the exercises train our minds to think along the lines the text sets forth. It is not what we think that transforms us, but how we think. The principles of miracles become mental habits in our problem-solving repertoire. Spiritual growth is not about becoming more metaphysically complicated, but rather it is about growing simpler as these very basic principles begin to permeate more and more deeply into our thought system. Meditation is time spent with God in silence and quiet listening. It is the time during which the Holy Spirit has a chance to enter into our minds and perform His divine alchemy. What changes because of this is not just what we do, but who we are. In the workbook of A Course in Miracles, which is a 365-day set of psychological exercises, we are given a very specific curriculum for relinquishing a thought system based on fear and accepting instead a thought system based on love. Each day, we're given a specific thought to focus on, eyes closed, for a specific amount of time. We're even told in the introduction that we don't have to like the exercises, and we might even be hostile to them, but we should just do them. Our attitude doesn't affect their efficacy in any way. If I'm lifting weights at the gym, I can either love the experience or hate it, but it doesn't really matter. All that affects my body is whether or not I lift the weights. So it is with meditation. Also, as with physical exercise, the effects of meditation are cumulative. When we go to the gym and work out for an hour, we don't really see any change in our bodies at the end of the hour. If we go every day for 30 days, however, then we do see a change. So it is with meditation. And sometimes we're not the ones who can see the change as much as others can. We might not even be aware of how much the quality of our energy, the invisible emanations of our minds, affect our environment and the people within it. But others do, and they respond accordingly. Spiritual practice supports the development of personal power. Spiritually powerful people are not necessarily people who do so much as they are people around whom things get done. Gandhi caused the British to leave India, but he wasn't a man who ran around a lot. Powerful forces swirled around him. President Kennedy is another example. Legislatively, he achieved relatively little, but he unleashed invisible forces within others that altered the consciousness of at least one American generation. At the highest level of our being, we don't do anything. We are at rest when the power of God, Spirit, the universe, works through us. Meditation is a profound relaxation. The ego's frantic voice, its vain imaginings, are burned away. We all have within us a direct radio line to the voice for God. The problem is, the radio is full of static. In our quiet times we spend with God, with Spirit, with the universe, the static melts away. We learn to hear the small, still voice for God. In heaven, that is the only voice we hear. That is why we are happy there. 4. Seeing the light. Child or light, you know not that the light is in you. Only the light within us is real. We are not afraid of the dark within ourselves so much as we are afraid of the light. The dark is familiar. It's what we know. Yet neither oblivion nor hell is as unacceptable to you as heaven. The light, the thought that we might indeed be good enough, is such a threat to the ego that it takes out its very big guns to defend against it. Someone I know remarked to me about a mutual friend, "He has a mean-spirited soul." "No, he doesn't," I replied. "He has a mean-spirited personality. His soul is one of the brightest I've ever seen. His mean-spiritedness is simply a defense against the light. If he were to let in his light and choose to really express all his love, it would overwhelm his ego. His meanness is his armor, his protection against the light." Our defense against light is always some form of guilt that we project onto ourselves or others. God can love us infinitely. The universe can support us unendingly. But until we agree with God's, Spirit's, the universe's kind appraisal of us, and the universe's merciful behavior, we will do everything in our power to keep the miracles we're entitled to at bay. Why the self-hatred? As we've already seen, the ego is our mind's endless need to attack itself. And how do we escape this? Through the acceptance of God's will as our own. God's will is that we be happy. God's will is that we forgive ourselves. God's will is that we find our place in heaven now. It is not our arrogance, but our humility which teaches us that who we are is good enough and what we have to say is valid. It is our own self-hatred that makes it difficult for us to consistently support and nurture other people, because supporting others amounts to supporting ourselves. When I speak publicly, there's a palpably different feeling between audiences who want me to win and those who are sitting back signaling, "Oh yeah? Show me." The former is a context in which I'm invited to shine, and the latter is one in which I'm challenged to shine. Isn't life challenging enough? Is human kindness so lightweight? When we know that love is an infinite resource, that there is enough abundance of every kind for everyone, and that only what we give to others we get to keep, then we stop denigrating other people and start blessing them instead. Several years ago, I was living in a house with a teenage girl. One day I came home and she was sitting on our bed with 5 or 6 girlfriends, surrounding a poster of Christy Brinkley. As hard as it is to believe, these girls were struggling to make a case for the fact that Christy Brinkley wasn't really all that beautiful, or if she was, she probably wasn't all that smart. I gently pointed out to them that what was really going on was that each of them wanted very much to look like her, just like her, but were defending against it because they thought it was impossible. "It's okay for you to want to be beautiful, too," I said. "In fact, it's good, and in your own ways you can be. The way to do that is to bless her beauty, praise it, permit it to be so you can permit your own. Christy Brinkley being beautiful doesn't mean that you don't get to be. There's enough beauty to go around. It's just an idea. Anyone can have it. As you bless what she has, you multiply your chances of having it, too." A person who succeeds in any area is only creating more of a possibility for others to do the same. Holding on to the thought of finite resources is a way of holding on to hell. We must learn to think only divine thoughts. Angels are the thoughts of God, and in heaven, humans think like angels. Angels light the way. Angels do not begrudge anyone anything. Angels do not tear down. Angels do not compete. Angels do not constrict their hearts. Angels do not fear. That's why they sing, and that's how they fly. We, of course, are only angels in disguise. 5. The end of the world. The end of the world is not its destruction, but its translation into heaven. The end of the world as we know it wouldn't be such a horrible thing if you think of all the ways in which the world is full of pain and suffering. In the end days, we will not escape the horrors of the world through vehicles that soar into outer space, but through vehicles that soar into inner space. Those vehicles are our healed minds, guided by the Holy Spirit. What does heaven look like? Most of us have only had tiny glimpses, but those glimpses were enough to keep us always hoping to go back. The Course says there's an ancient melody we all remember, always beckoning, always calling us to return. Heaven is our home. It's where we came from. It's our natural state. We've all had heavenly moments on earth, usually at our mother's breast or at someone else's. There's a feeling of inner peace that comes from total relinquishment of judgment. We don't feel the need to change others, and we don't feel the need to be different than we are. We can see, for whatever reason, the total beauty of another person, and we feel that they can see the beauty in us as well. The world sees a special relationship, whether romantic or otherwise, as the only valid context for such an experience. That is our primary neurosis, our most painful delusion. We keep looking to the body for love, but it is not there. We embark upon an endless search for what we cannot find. One person, one circumstance that holds the key to heaven. But heaven is within us. It has nothing ultimately to do with the thoughts of someone else, and everything to do with what we choose to think ourselves. Not just about one person, but about all people. So forgiveness of mankind, of everyone in every circumstance, is our ticket to heaven, our only way home. Our goal is God, Spirit, the universe. Nothing short of that goal will bring us joy, and it is joy to which we are entitled. Although we're relatively aware of the transformative power of pain, we know very little about the transformative power of joy because we know so little about joy at all. Talk of joy is not simplistic. No one is saying that it's easy. We're just affirming that it's our goal. As we've already seen, there is no getting to heaven without acknowledging hell. Not its ultimate reality, but its reality for us while we remain in this illusion. This illusion is very powerful indeed. A Course in Miracles is not proposing emotional denial and suppression of darkness as a way to light. It is a psychotherapeutic process by which darkness is brought to light, not the other way around. In the enlightened world, psychotherapy, guided by the Holy Spirit, will certainly have a place. According to the Course, no one can escape from illusion unless he looks at them, for not looking is the way they are protected. The way to heaven is fraught with demons on the side of the road, just as the fairy tale castle is surrounded by dragons. A Course in Miracles says, "What is healing but the removal of all that stands in the way of knowledge? How else can one dispel illusions except by looking at them directly without protecting them? The work toward enlightenment often entails a painful and not very pretty arousal of the worst of which we're capable, made plain to both ourselves and others, in order that we might consciously choose to release our personal darkness. But without a commitment to light, a conscious intent to go for heaven, we remain enamored of darkness, too tempted by its complexities. The temptation to analyze darkness as a way to light is illustrated in some traditional psychotherapeutic models. When used by the ego, psychotherapy is a tool for endless ego investigation, assignment of blame, and focus on the past. When used by the Holy Spirit, it is a search for light. It is a sacred interaction in which two people together, consciously or unconsciously, invite the Holy Spirit to enter into their relationship and to transform painful perceptions into loving knowledge. The only reason we all need therapy so much is because we've lost an essential connection to the meaning of friendship. Real friendship, of any kind, is a form of psychotherapy, as is true religion. The Holy Spirit psychotherapists, professional or otherwise, ask only to accept the atonement for themselves, that their own healed perceptions might help enlighten others. In the world to come, couples will use psychotherapy more and more frequently, not as crisis counseling, but as maintenance procedure. There was a time when most people saw therapy as something you did only if you were crazy. Now we see it as a valuable tool for staying sane. So it is that couples will come to see the value in a constant and consistent formal evaluation of their thoughts and feelings as they walk two by two into the arms of God, of Spirit, of the universe. Just outside of Heaven's Gate, there's a lot of action, all within an illusion, of course, but an illusion that must be transformed from within. The only meaning of any event within the world of form is that it stimulates within us an impulse to reach for the gate or turn our back on heaven. As we stand before the gate, uncertain of which way to go, impelled to love and yet so trained to fear, we need to realize the sacred responsibility that has been placed in our hands. And so you walk toward heaven or toward hell, but not alone. We choose for everyone for many years to come. The decisions we make today, individually and collectively, will determine whether the planet goes to hell or goes to heaven. One thing, however, is sure. We are the transitional generation. The critical choices lie in our hands. Future generations will know who we were. They will think of us often. They will curse us, or they will bless us. 6. Heaven's Gate. Think not the way to Heaven's Gate is difficult at all. We are poised at Heaven's Gate. In our minds, we left there millions of years ago. Today, we are returning home. We are a prodigal son generation. We left home, and now there's an excitement in the air because we're back. We did everything to violate love of ourselves and others before a life of wholesomeness began to attract us. That's not our shame, but our strength. There are certain doors we don't have to go through because a false moralism said not to, but because we opened them already and we know they lead nowhere. Oddly enough, this gives us a kind of moral authority. We speak from experience. We've done the dark side. We're ready to move on. We're attracted to the light. When Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was asked by his disciples, "Why does it say in Scripture God loves a sinner?" His answer was, "They tend to be more interesting people." We're an interesting generation. We just don't see that about ourselves. When I first realized what a decisive time this is, that the decisions made on this planet in the next 20 years will determine whether or not mankind survives much longer, I was afraid for the world. The fate of the world is left up to us. Not us, I thought, anyone but us. We're spoiled brats, morally bankrupt. But when I looked more closely, what I saw surprised me. We're not bad. We're wounded. And our wounds are simply our opportunities to heal. Well, we're close to the end of this book, and we will finish it probably in the next week. As always, I wish you all a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.